I'm Chuck Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. I'm university pastor, that's like chaplain, at Capital University, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, Capital University, Columbus, Ohio. Capital University is one of the fine institutions of higher education of the American Lutheran Church. We are the St. Olaf of the East. Most of you know St. Olaf, you know, Capital's the same affiliation. One of the distinctive things about Capital University is that it has a law school. There are two Lutheran law schools in the United States, one at Valparaiso and the other at Capital. Capital is much bigger and much better than Valparaiso. There are a lot of people that really don't know that there are Lutheran law schools in the States. All right, so that's who I am. With this topic, instant cures, success, fulfillment are the devil's promise, I have a goal. And the goal doesn't sound at all like the title. The goal is that we come to an acceptance of life and self with an increase of faith that allows us to live as if Jesus Christ is Lord. Now, that's really my objective, and I'd like to repeat that, that somehow we come to an acceptance of life and of ourselves with an increase of faith that allows us to live as if Jesus Christ is really Lord. I'm going to start with a derogatory kind of statement about one of the most popular events now in the United States. And that has to do with that person jogging past you any morning or any evening as you're going or coming from work. And the statement is that jogging causing glee on the face of devil or God? Jogging is one of the things in which we engage these days with a great deal of hope and promise. And is the hope and the promise that we are encountering in our jogging the work of God or of the devil? In a fascinating little book called Psychobabble, I'll say more about that in a little bit, the journalist who writes this book shares this little spook. Now, this is something apart from jogging. He says, in 1972, another journalist and I conceived a small plot. The weekly newspaper we worked for was at that particular stage in its growth, open to harmless pranks, and we decided to invent a cult in western Massachusetts in order to write a feature story about it. We called our imaginary commune Sanzuki, and thinking to spoof the various cults that had recently won the attention of the mass media, reported that the communards were involved in trying to reach two states on the spiritual continuum. The first was the state of vegetable consciousness, called broccoli, and the second a state described in neuropsychological gibberish as a resignation to the primacy of the reptile brain. Although the story contained several believable anecdotes, we thought we had had been careful enough to include enough ludicrous details to make clear our intention. There was the ethereal ex-medical student and now commune leader named Bob, known also as the head lettuce. There were scenes of violence among vegetarians and one of a woman curled up into a ball pretending she was a tomato. But as you probably imagine, our joke was more successful than we had ever imagined. Not only did the newspaper receive a handful of letters asking soberly for more information about Sanzuki, but even members of the newspaper staff, perhaps already numbed by front-page lunacy, were surprised to discover that such a place did not, in fact, exist. You, I'm sure, are conscious of the countless kinds of gurus and religious sort of cults that are sweeping the country and have been sweeping the country, maybe speaking to some deficiencies in the church, but also offering some spiritual promises an inward kind of realization of self or some kind of communion with the elements and with the world, some kind of an escape. There are also the multitude of non-religious kind of cultish activities, offering promises, success, fulfillment. Have any of you recently toured through a bookstore and gotten into the self-help kind of situations, the little bookshelf? What do you find there? What kind of self-help can you discover in the bookstores? Can you say anything more about the kind of psychologies that are there? Okay. One wonders whether it's legitimate or illegitimate, but there is psychological assistance in better feelings, getting out of depression. Anything else, maybe, that you've read or carried?
Fit or fat.
Pardon me?
Fit or fat.
Fit or fat. That's an exercise book?
Diet exercise.
Diet exercise. Is it anything like the exercises that go on TV in the morning or sometimes in the evening? I wonder sometimes whether those are exercise shows or exhibits in erotica.
Actually, I did it both.
Is that right? They are exercise shows as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if any of you have problems. Somebody else had, yes?
Looking out for number one.
Ooh, looking out for number one. If Jane came with a book, I'd buy it. Somebody else had a hand up here. Yeah. Pardon me? All right. Sky's limit. I think you... Here. Oh, yeah. Making a million in no time. All kinds of things like that. Even by income tax evasion. You know, guarantee of making a mint without your own money. All kinds of things like that. Roth has a little statement in here that may be helpful to us just to sort of summarize. He's the guy who wrote this book, but he says, there is more self-help and psychological advice literature on the bookshelves right now than ever before. Your inner conflicts, how to solve them, how to give and receive advice, how to live with another person, free to love, creating and sustaining intimacy in marriage, stand up, speak out, talk back, when I don't like myself, you know, all kinds of advice and assistance. Here's a promise in a little blurb about a book, the Do-It-Yourself Psychotherapy book. This book will save you thousands of dollars and give you control of your own life and your best self. No more paid advisors, sex hang-ups, feelings of inferiority, psychosomatic illnesses, guilt. Enjoy more personal power, boundless sensual pleasure, newfound self-reliance, your birthright of health, new lifestyles. Pardon me? You want to buy it? Okay, there's all kinds of this self-help promises, cures that are available to us in these days. I have to be tender here, because I think sometimes those books can offer us a good deal of help. And maybe, you know, it's hard to decide whether it's the work of the devil or the work of God as we deal with some of those books. But it could be that the outlandish promises are obviously, for us, the work of the devil. You mentioned psychology, and this appeared in a number of the titles. How about some of the phrases that we use in our day that this writer called psychobabble? It's kind of a unique current, almost psychology jargon. What are some of the phrases you use very often? Uptight. Do your own thing. Hang loose.
What turns you on?
Find yourself. Pardon?
Find yourself.
Where are you coming from?
Ah,
yeah. I'm very comfortable with something.
But how do you feel?
How do you feel? Somebody says that confession is the new handshake. You say to somebody in old jargon, how are you? And oh, you know, from there it goes on. My wife and I don't get along sexually, and oh, geez. It's just, you know, a kind of openness that seems to be openness, but maybe a real concealing of our real kind of problem. There's a cute little episode in here. He reports that while having drinks a couple of years ago, I can't see too good with these glasses. I got to take them off.
I take mine off when I really want to see.
While having drinks a couple of years ago with a young woman I had not seen for some time, I asked how things were going and received this reply. I've really been getting in touch with myself lately. I've struck some really deep chords. I winced at the grandeur of her remarks, but she proceeded undaunted to reel out a string of broad psychological insights with an enthusiasm I kept thinking I was disappointing her with my failure to introduce more lyricism and intensity into my own conversation. Now that circumspection and reticence had gone out of style, I felt obliged to reciprocate her candor, but couldn't bring myself to use the popular catchphrases of revelation. Would she understand if I said that instead of striking deep chords, I had merely tickled the ivories of my psychic piano? That getting my head together was not exactly the way in which I wished to describe the sensation from my neck up. Would I wonder, do any good if I resorted to more precise clinical language and admitted that I was well on the way to resolving my attitude toward my maternal introject? Whenever I see you, she said brightly, it makes me feel so good inside. It's a real high energy experience. So what was wrong with me that I couldn't feel the full voltage of our contact? Unable to match her incandescence, I muttered, yes, it's good to see you. Then I fell in silence. Finally, she said, her beatific smile widening, but I can really dig your silence. If you're bummed out, that's okay. The kind of jargon that we think is defining who and what we are is probably in the end evading who or what we are and what we are really feeling. Are you getting the idea that in our society, in our culture, we are living not only with religious kind of themes, but we are also living with a kind of pop psychology sort of themes that are awakening us up, that are turning us on, that are promising us cures and fulfillment and marvelous types of sensations and the experience of our whole being, that are turning us on or trying to turn us on to a world that is a kind of an internal world. That we've got an awful lot of this going on. I'm sure you could cite many, many more examples, but you have a feeling of what it is that I'm trying to say. And I'm saying, in essence, that that kind of turn-on, introspection, self-discovery, instant fulfillment, instant cure, instant success, in whatever area it might be applied, I'm suggesting to you that that's probably the devil's work. Now, why would I make that kind of suggestion? Philip Roth says that's the kind of situation because the idea of being cured has been fetishized. Mental health is thought of less and less as the capacity to confront, explore, and transmute the sometimes irreducible contradictions of living. See, we think of mental health less as trying to work at those things, as more and more a total triumph of all that threatens the autonomy of the individual. That's a profound kind of statement that says we think more of mental health as just transcending the difficulties rather than struggling with the problems. so he would say all this psychobabble is the work of the devil. He says this also, that the whole business of introspection, self-fulfillment, is so much the work of an individual, of individuals, that we have lost sense of community. Finding traditional sorts of faith no longer useful and turned to himself under the auspices of modern psychology, individuals, he, she, become a victim of their own interminable introspection and acquired the belief that a sense of well-being has become the end rather than a byproduct of striving after some superior communal end. A belief that a sense of well-being has become the end rather than a sense of well-being over striving towards some greater communal kind of end or good. Another one in here, and then I'm done with Philip Roth. Is it that society has become so atomized, so individualistic, you know, so much me-oriented, that the emotional strength once derived from communities, the extended family, and the simple observation of life is now thought to be obtainable only from self-help books? Kind of sense of well-being and strength that we used to get from family, etc., we think nowadays that we can only get it by ourselves from self-help kinds of books. In other words, when you can't handle the frustrations of life, withdraw into yourself. When you can't improve society and the conditions around you, improve yourself. I think, you know, you work with that which is manageable. It's a new kind of escape into our self-actualization, our self-fulfillment. Roth has a devastating statement in here. He says that our effort to overcome the dehumanization of our society through self-improvement is to admit the ultimate victory of the dehumanization of our society. I think you can follow that. That, you know, we work so hard, it's so frustrating in life to overcome the difficulties of life. And because we can't do that, we resort to strengthening and building up ourselves. And in that process, sort of admit that the problems of society have won and that we're defeated. One of the most devastating, but it's kind of fascinating, commentaries on this whole self-help kind of thing comes from Christopher Lash, and I used him in some discussion about education last night. But in this book, Culture of Narcissism, he says this. I'm going to read a couple of rather lengthy phrases here. Then we can get into some conclusions and some reaction and discussion to this thing. The growing despair of changing society, even of understanding it, which also underlies the cult of expanded consciousness, health, and personal growth so prevalent today. That's not a sentence. It doesn't end. There's a verb missing there someplace. It's because I didn't start at the right place. But he's talking about the same problem of personal growth and self-fulfillment, that kind of stuff. After the political toil of the 60s, Americans have retreated to purely personal preoccupations. Having no hope of improving their lives in any of the ways that matter, people have convinced themselves that what matters is psychic self-improvement, getting in touch with their feelings, eating health food, taking lessons in ballet or belly dancing, impressing themselves in the wisdom of the East, jogging, learning how to relate, overcome the fear of pleasure, harmless in themselves, these pursuits elevated to a program and wrapped in the rhetoric of authenticity and awareness, signify a retreat from politics and a repudiation of the recent past. Indeed, Americans seem to wish to forget not only the 60s, the riots, the New Left, the disruptions on college campuses, Vietnam, Watergate, and the Nixon presidency, but their entire collective past. To live for the moment is the prevailing passion, to live for yourself, not for your predecessors or posterity. We are fast losing the sense of historical continuity, the sense of belonging to a succession of generations originating in the past and stretching into the future. It is the waning of the sense of historical time, in particular, the erosion of any strong concern for posterity, that distinguishes the spiritual crisis of our time. This man is saying that, you know, the leap into ourselves is to say that we have leaped out of history, both past history and a concern about the future. I want to make more comments about that in a moment. But this other phrase, this other little comment by Lash: plagued by anxiety, depression, vague discontents, a sense of inner emptiness, the psychological man of the 20th century seeks neither individual self-aggrandizement nor spiritual transcendence, but peace of mind under conditions that increasingly militate against it. Therapists become his principal allies in the struggle for composure. He turns to them in the hope of achieving the modern equivalent of salvation, mental health. This does not mean that the triumph of the therapeutic has become a new religion in its own right. Therapy constitutes an anti-religion because it gives no thought to anything beyond the immediate needs. Even when therapists speak of the need for meaning and love, they define love and meaning simply as the fulfillment of the patient's emotional requirements. It hardly occurs to them, nor is there any reason why it should, given the nature of the therapeutic enterprise, to encourage the subject to subordinate his needs and interests to those of others, to someone or some cause or tradition outside himself. Love as self-sacrifice or self-abasement, meaning as submission to a higher loyalty, these sublimations strike the therapeutic sensibility as intolerably expressive, offensive to common sense, and injurious to personal health and well-being. To liberate humanity from such outmoded ideas of love and duty has become the mission of the post-Freudian therapies, and particularly of their converts and popularizers, for whom mental health means the overthrow of inhibitions and the immediate gratification of every impulse. You know, if I'd learned better how to read in high school, I could probably do a better job with that. But I think the judgment is clear. There's always the danger. He makes a severe generalization in terms of modern psychology, that it has led us into some avenues that are unhealthy. I do not want to knock psychology and psychotherapy and all of that business. It's very important and very central and very helpful. What he's saying is that we have maybe gone overboard in popularizing a lot of Freudian value into a kind of escapism. We have a fine professor at Capital University, a psychologist, a woman psychologist, not really a church member, but a woman who is very, very concerned about values and wrestling constantly with the demand of Jesus Christ upon her life, and as yet has not joined the church. But, well, she belongs to a church, but it's the wrong one. It's not Lutheran. Invited her to speak in chapel, and these are some comments out of... She says, psychologists and theologians need to be joined together in fighting evil, she says. To do evil, we do not have to inflict direct overt harm on others. We also do evil when we become preoccupied with frippery or trivialities, or engage in self-glorifying pursuits. Too many recent popular therapies have been clever inventions to self-preoccupation and self-glorification. When we indulge in that, we have little time left over for God's serious work. And this. She reviews all these pop psychology books, and she gets promotions on all these psychology books, and she reads review on those. And the books are still coming. This was a 1980 presentation, 81 presentation. And the books are still offering all kinds of quick, immediate cures, transformational thought and all kinds of stuff. And here's the man from Stanford, Paul Robinson, who makes this very astute observation about a lot of those promises. And I think also he has here a clear understanding of what it means to be a human being. He uses the word man, so I'll use it. Man is only so tall. He lives only so long. He is only so smart. His existence is defined by limits. These limits may expand or contract, but they will not cease to be limits. To dream of endless personal transformation is to remain an intellectual child. Growing up means taking stock of our less than ideal circumstances and using our minds as best we can to improve those circumstances in which improvement is possible. And the book that he is referring to betrays a psychological immaturity and a contempt for the mind that are truly chilling. This historian says the psychobabble kind of stuff, the promises are really inhuman. They tempt us to go beyond what it means to be a human being. And this final statement from our psychology professor, who says, "I invite the church to explore with educators any sane means for taking some intellectual potshots at all of this mischief. Particularly, means for helping frightened people reclaim the use of their brains. I invite no one on a crusade to crush or howl against popular nonsense. That would merely be another piece of self-inflation and self-righteousness. Challenging young people and adults to use their little gray cells is the answer. Challenging them to involve grown-up faith that can sustain them in this terrifying age is the answer. A grown-up faith in a terrorizing age, rather than a resorting to the kind of feel-good promises that so much of our society offers for us." I've been at Holden now 2 weeks, not quite 2 weeks, and even if I think just about this week, in this week you've been asked to think about peace and nonviolence and nuclear bombs and all that kind of business. A totally frustrating sort of subject. What do you do with it? It just overwhelms you. Monday night, you talked about, Tuesday night, Global 2000. Talking about use of resources and conservation and the future and life changes. How can I, you wonder, become part of a process that has anything to do with the future? That, too, seems so overwhelming. You can save your food or whatever and eat lettuce and all that kind of stuff. How can you? Last night we talked about education. Wow, the magnitude of the educational problem and issue as far as the whole nation goes. You stand before all of that kind of business in total frustration and you feel as if you can't cure it. So what do? You improve yourself. You can't manage the scene, so you work with the sensible. And in the midst of all of that frustration, you feel good about yourself. So I start out with my original judgment that as you jog by, feel good, you're developing yourself. It's the devil who's smiling. Okay, I'm ready for you to jump in and holler at that. Bad to bad. Think about that. I think the way I would answer that question, and I don't want to be flippant in it, but I think I would say simply that God's gift becomes the devil's tool. That there is nothing that's either right or wrong, good or bad. But that probably, out of psychology and out of even some of the popularization of psychology, there has been some benefit, probably a lot of benefit to individuals to help them discover, find themselves. But that gift then can turn into evil. Yeah, with abuse, overuse. And I think that's kind of what has happened. You can help me on that kind of thing. I think the point that the writer is trying to make is it's a different thrust, you know, to instead of find ourselves as individuals who don't need the rest of the world and the rest of the community, but to truly view the human being as a social animal, part of community. You want to comment?
Yes, a trend in psychotherapy is...
Speak up a little louder.
A trend in therapies is moving away.
One of the points that Lash makes in terms of his whole book is that we have no more frontiers to explore. That as long as Americans could go someplace else, could move, they were healthy. But now that we can't do that anymore, whether it's because of resources or absence of land, we can't do that anymore. So we need to face our limits. We have to struggle with the things that sort of imprison us. And because it was easier to just move than it was to improve your neighborhood, out of the frustration over not being able to improve the neighborhood, we resort to improving ourselves. Yeah. Thank you. Everybody is so fascinated with E.T. And I says, it's a fun story, but it's terrible theology. You know, if you really think about it, that love is only in some sort of otherworldly kind of a creature, and that you can't experience love for your fellow human being, and that the answer, you know, to our need has to always come from some lovable, ugly thing from someplace else rather than, you know, our own kind of a community. It's a fun movie, but I think it can lead you into some kind of false hopes. I think they experience the total futility of their flight, and they're worse off at the end than they were at the beginning. Probably. They bop into some neat little things about Jerry Rubin, who found fulfillment and mental health in political crusades. Jerry Rubin is now into self-fulfillment. You know, he didn't find himself in those things, and now he's born again or something. Let's do 1, 2. You speak to a very important concern for the church toward those who are on some sort of pilgrimage of discovering themselves. I think there's another judgment that the church has very often picked up some of the quick cures that are promised in pop psychology and confused that with the gospel. The pop cures do not face life as a reality and offer a kind of false hope. And I think too often the church has gone along with the ease and the peace of mind and has not offered a gospel that faces realistically the kind of hardship, suffering that life is. I think there was somebody over here, and then you, and then back there. Was there a comment coming here? Lent. Let's eliminate negative thinking. Isn't that a neat theme for Lent? That's really cross theology, isn't it? Oh, it's great. Something good is going to happen to you. What is it, though, that makes it impossible for many to really proclaim the cross without a great deal of difficulty? I think culturally what makes it difficult to proclaim the cross is that our people are caught up consciously and willingly and knowingly in this kind of quick cure mentality. And so I think you need to sort of call a spade and say, hey, look at, you know, you've been misled. And why? And sometimes these things help us see where we have placed our faith in. All right, see, you're saying that you can use something like that for good, for benefit.
Not necessarily. I mean that.
our professor at Capital would say that you have the gray matter to deal with the subject. And that's what she's calling for, too. You know, you read all this stuff, read it, have fun, enjoy it, but know where it's good. And an oversimplification of something, you know, that gives you peace, pleasure. I was going to offer, and I don't know if I have the guts to do it, but another one of these little discussion called the three latest idols of the church. Salvation, resurrection, and, geez, I forgot the third one. It really doesn't make much difference what the third one is, but maybe it was heaven, I'm not sure. But we get so engrossed with those things that we really idolize them and forget who gave them. You could do that too. You could talk about Jesus as idol. Yeah, that really shakes you up, but it forces you to think, am I doing that with my faith? Am I doing that with my psychology? Yeah, I don't know whether the people wear those earphones out of a desperate desire to hear someone talk to them or to not hear someone talk.
The next generation, when these kids have gone through this training, when they parents also have ears.
The idea is that the parent makes the tape.
I think the ultimate trip is to jog a marathon with a headset on.
Yep. I started out saying that I had a goal in mind, and the goal was that you accept yourself and that you find a strength of faith that allows you to live with Jesus Christ as really being your Lord. And I hope that the kind of conversation that we've engaged in to sort of evaluate the stuff that leads us and the stuff that leads us astray and the stuff that offers us some false kind of hopes will lead us to the point of saying, we are who we are, and we're mixed up in a frustrating world. And instead of trying to find a way out of that world, you know, we can live with Jesus Christ as Lord, because that Lord affirmed the kind of existence that we have. He didn't affirm some sort of peace of mind. Well, false peace of mind, you know. He affirmed an involvement in living without resorting to any kind of false gospels, a kind of living whereby he can be Lord. Maybe that's too complicated, I don't know. But don't put your confidence and trust in quick cures. Put your confidence and trust in, you know, the only cure, kind of the eternal God. It's time to eat. Thanks, you were a good audience.